Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the roundtable webinar on Copyright and Idea Theft Issues in the Film Industry. This webinar is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with Kelly Dry and Warren LLP. The speakers are David Fink, Partner, Entertainment and Media Practice Group, Kelly Dry and Warren LLP. Lee Bronner, Partner, Entertainment and Media Practice Group, Kelly Dry, Warren LLP. And Hajir Ardhitale, Special Counsel, Entertainment Litigation, Kelly Dry, Warren LLP. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Android, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session over to Mr. Lee Bronner. Thank you, and over to you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the roundtable webinar on Copyright and Idea Theft Issues in the Film Industry. This webinar is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with Kelly Dry and Warren LLP. The speakers are David Fink, Partner, Entertainment and Media Practice Group, Kelly Dry and Warren LLP. Lee Bronner, Partner, Entertainment and Media Practice Group, Kelly Dry, Warren LLP. And Hajir Ardhitale, Special Counsel, Entertainment Litigation, Kelly Dry, Warren LLP. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Android, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session over to Mr. Lee Bronner. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
We also hear they always seem to ask for $10 million in damages for some reason. I have no idea why that's a common theme, but it's every single time it's $10 million, $10 million. But there's important differences in the claims, which we'll get into in greater detail. But the most fundamental one that's worth knowing is under copyright law, an idea cannot be protected. It's just not protected by the Copyright Act. So even the general idea for a movie or a television show, that's free for the taking under the Copyright Act. Anyone can use it. Now, but that's not true under California's and New York's idea submission law. So ideas, and we can see not even terribly well-developed ideas, those can be protected and can be the basis of lawsuits and can be really valuable. But most important for our purposes today, plaintiffs can and do bring both types of claims in the same lawsuit. So they allege that the defendant infringed their work, or if they didn't, they allege that, hey, you stole my idea and you owe me money because we have an implied contract. But the point is, however they can get there, they want to be paid for the use of their work, they want to be paid for the use of their idea that shows up on a television show or movie. So these so-called idea theft claims often arise, not always, but often arise in the context of pitch meetings. The plaintiff goes to a company or meets with some company representatives and gives their pitch. The company says no, and then sometime later, the plaintiff sees that the company is using an idea very similar to the one that was in the pitch. And so they file a lawsuit. They want to get paid. So not everyone knows what these pitch meetings tend to look like. So before we get too far into the legal principles, I thought it might be fitting to show a clip from an old movie called Sunset Boulevard, where a struggling screenwriter makes a pitch to a studio head. And Roxy, I'm hoping you can show that clip for me.
I had an original story kicking around Paramount. My agent told me it was dead as a doornail. But I knew a big shot over there who'd always like me. And the time had come to take a look back. His name was Taylor. He was a smart producer with a set of ulcers to prove it.
All right, Gillis, you've got 5 minutes. What's the story about?
It's about a baseball player. It's a shortstop that's batting 347.
Uh-huh.
Poor kid was once mixed up in a hole. He's trying to go straight.
Uh-huh.
Except there are a bunch of gamblers that won't let him.
So they tell the poor kid he's got to throw the World Series or else, huh?
More or less, except for the end, I've got a gimmick that's real good.
All right. You got a title?
Bases Loaded. There's a 40-page outline.
Call Reader's Department. Find out what they have on the bases list.
They're pretty hot about it over 20th. Except I think Danny's all wet. Can you see Ty Power as the shortstop?
Mm-hmm.
You got the best man for it right here on this lot, Alan Ladd.
They could change a pace for that.
And there's another thing. It's pretty simple to shoot. Hunt outdoor stuff. I bet you could make the whole thing for under $1 million.
Excuse me.
And there's a great little part for Bill Dimmers. One of the trainers. An old-time player who got beaten. Goes out of his head sometimes.
Hello, Mr. Sheldrake.
Hello.
On that Bases Loaded, I covered it with a 2-page synopsis.
Thank you.
But I wouldn't bother.
What's wrong with it?
It's from hunger.
Nothing for lads?
Oh, it's just a rehash of something that wasn't very good to begin with.
I'm sure you'll be glad to meet Mr. Gillis. You wrote it. This is Miss Kramer.
Schaefer. Betty Schaefer. Right now, I wish I could crawl in a hole and pull it in after me.
If I could be of any help.
Getting back to the presentation, so you just saw a pitch, a standard Hollywood pitch, and lawsuits can arise from pitches just like this, although it's far from the only way to draw a claim. So, at this point, now, at this point, I'm going to start off by discussing some recent developments and trends in copyright infringement cases. Then Hajir is going to talk about copyright principles and how they've played out in some recent infringement cases. And then David Fink is going to talk about recent developments in state law idea submission claims, that comparable claim, and provide a few tips on how to avoid these sorts of lawsuits in the first place. Now, at this point, I'd like to start off by discussing a few very basic copyright principles under United States federal law. So a copyright is the protection the law gives an author's original literary work. Most simply put, and the easiest way that I think about it is, a copyright is the exclusive right to copy. It includes the right to prepare new works based upon that original copyrighted work as well. So the owner has a right to enforce these rights to exclude others from copying. And that's really all a copyright infringement action is. So there's only two basic elements of a copyright infringement claim. Ownership, that the plaintiff is the owner of a valid copyright, and copying, that the defendant copied elements of the plaintiff's work which are original to the author and otherwise subject to copyright protection. And we'll get into that in a little bit as well. Now, normally, it's not possible to show direct evidence of copying. No one sees the defendant copying their work and sitting there scribbling and copying like you can see kids in school. So plaintiffs most commonly attempt to establish copying circumstantially by demonstrating that the defendant had access to the plaintiff's work and that the two works are substantially similar in expression. Now, to prove copying, a plaintiff had to show both access and substantial similarity. One without the other is not going to suffice. So the first question that arises is, what constitutes access? How do you show it? Because the burden of proving access lies squarely on the plaintiff's shoulders. The plaintiff has to prove it. Now, it might surprise some of you to hear that the plaintiff doesn't have to show that anyone actually saw or read his work. He doesn't have to show that at all. Rather, to prove access, the plaintiff is required to show only that there was a reasonable possibility that the defendant had a simple opportunity to look at the plaintiff's work. Not that he saw it, but that he had an opportunity to see it. Now, I like to think of it this way. To show access, it must be reasonably possible that the paths of the alleged infringer, pictured here on the left, and the plaintiff's work intersected at some point. So what is this, you know, what is this intersection? That is access. And that intersection can happen in a number of different ways. The most common ways are wide dissemination, that the plaintiff's work is readily available on the market. So maybe even looking on Amazon, or it's widespread, everyone can see it. A direct submission. A direct submission is just like that Sunset Boulevard pitch we saw, where someone actually, you know, you pitch it to somebody. And then the other one that we see is a third-party contact, often referred out here as an intermediary. That's where I give it to somebody, and then someone turns around and gives it to another person. A lot of claims arise that way. And access can really arise unexpectedly. Plaintiffs out here have tried to claim access through casual conversations at cocktail parties. You really got to watch out for that. Through mutual friends, there was one case we're aware of where someone submitted it to a chiropractor who happened to be friends with an executive at a production company. So you really have to watch out because, you know, it can arise in a number of different ways. And I thought I'd give an example how access can arise unexpectedly from a case we handled out here. The case I'm going to talk about today is Robinson versus the CW Network, which is a television network. In this case, Stacey Robinson, she was the writer of an unpublished novel entitled Interceptions. It was a dark and very dramatic story about a woman who's engaged to a professional football player. Miss Robinson learns that her boyfriend has an ex-girlfriend who works at the television station, and she's a comedy writer on a television show called Girlfriends. A pretty popular show out here in some circles, but not everybody's heard of it. Anyway, the unpublished writer asks her boyfriend to call in a favor. Says, hey, can you contact your ex-girlfriend for me and see if you can, maybe I can get a job as a writer's assistant on this show. I'd really like to interview and get my foot in the door. So the ex-girlfriend, as you might, she was pretty reluctant about it, but she says, yeah, it's fine. And she interviews Miss Robinson way back in 2001. Now, as part of this interview, the ex-girlfriend at the studio asked Miss Robinson to give a writing sample, a teleplay. She says, a teleplay. Teleplays tend to be about 35, 40, maybe 50 pages. They're double-spaced. You can read them incredibly quickly. They're really pretty small. But instead, Miss Robinson handed her 275-page novel Interceptions. And the ex-girlfriend was the head writer of this comedy series, didn't have any time to read this 275-page novel. She threw it right in the trash. Nevertheless, there was clear access under the law. Access, plain and simple, direct submission. Now, let me tell you a little bit something about Interceptions. That novel, which I had the dubious honor of reading, was a story about a woman who lost her own identity when she was physically abused by her fiancé, who was a football player who was consistently unfaithful. He humiliated her over and over again. She contemplates suicide, and the very end of the book, and spoiler alert, she sits alone on a bus, contemplates her terrible life, and cries. That's the novel. The reason I tell you this is it probably won't surprise you to learn that she did not get the job on the comedy series. She did not have a shot at that. She did not get the job. But cut to 5 years later, and Stacey Robinson sees this advertisement. It's for The Game. It's a new show on the network, and it's written by the ex-girlfriend, or the writer from that other girlfriend show. And she looks at this, and she says, this is a blatant, unmistakable ripoff of my novel, Interception. The Game, unlike Interception, was a half-hour comedy television show. It came with a laugh track. It was light and bubbly, romantic, upbeat. Other than having a professional football player in it, it bore virtually no resemblance whatsoever to Interceptions. But nevertheless, because there was that clear access to her book from that writing interview years earlier, Miss Robinson brought a variety of claims. She brought claims for copyright infringement, a series of idea submission claims. My personal favorite was the second one down here, fraud, where she alleged that the entire job interview process at the television network was a ruse so everyone could get their hands on her unpublished novel. So the way this played out is we filed a motion to dismiss out here under the federal rules. The court on its own motion converted that to a motion for summary judgment, read the two works himself, and said, look, these works are radically different. And after that hearing, the plaintiff lawyer pulled me out in the hall and basically said, hey, can we settle this case, which happened. I'll let you use your imagination of what the number might have been, but whatever you're thinking is too high. All right. So, but there isn't, oftentimes there isn't such clear access like there was here. And that really played out in a case that was decided last year involving Sylvester Stallone. I don't know if many of you have seen The Expendables, a movie Sylvester Stallone wrote, but it was the subject of a lawsuit, this Webb versus Stallone lawsuit. So in this Webb versus Stallone case, plaintiff Marcus Webb, he was a budding screenwriter. He'd written a number of screenplays, but none of them had ever been produced. Back in 2006, he wrote a screenplay called The Cordoba Keeper, which featured an elite, highly trained team of American mercenaries who were hired to defeat a Latin American dictator called General Garza. 2 years later, in 2008, Sylvester Stallone wrote a screenplay entitled The Expendables, which was made a movie, which was about an elite, highly trained team of American mercenaries who were hired to defeat a Latin American dictator, also named General Garza. So this movie was released in 2010, and just a couple months later, Webb said, look, this is absolutely absurd, I've got to sue. So he sued, Webb sued Stallone, he sued the distributors, he sued the producers, everyone he could think of, he sued them all for copyright infringement. But Mr. Webb had a serious problem. The serious problem was this: how is he going to show access? How is he going to show that the writer of the movie somehow had an intersection with his work called The Cordoba Keeper? Not all of us know Sylvester Stallone. Webb didn't know Sylvester Stallone. They weren't friends. They didn't really have any acquaintances. So he took Mr. Stallone's deposition. And during deposition, Mr. Stallone said he actually read 15 different screenplays in making the Expendables. But when asked where he got them or what they were, he said, I don't know. Not really strong evidence for anybody. But the court said, look, that's not really enough evidence. Him not knowing what he read or didn't read is enough evidence, and the plaintiff has the burden of proof here to show access. He has to show it. He has the burden. So Webb came forward and said, well, I submitted my screenplay to a bunch of different amateur screenplay contests. There's a lot of them out here, tons and tons of those screenplay contests. And he said, well, look, the judges of those contests, they are really tied into the entertainment industry. It just seems clear to me that someone must have given my screenplay to Sylvester Stallone. And the court rejected that theory of access, too. The court said, look, you can't prove access by speculation or conjecture. Any plaintiff in these sorts of cases has to come forward with significant probative evidence of access. And here, Webb didn't say that he won any of those competitions. I've seen a lot of those competitions myself, and they can get thousands and thousands of screenplays. So it's really just amazingly unlikely that it would really have dwindled down and then someone involved would have given it to Stallone. That's just pure speculation. That's not enough to state a claim. So the court granted summary judgment in favor of Stallone and the other defendants and dismissed the entire lawsuit. But Webb tried one last tactic, and he basically said, look, come on. They're both about elite, highly trained teams of American mercenaries. Look, going after General Garza, that's just, it's too similar. He had to have it. And there is some law, which we don't have to get too far into it today, but the judge said, look, if you want to make that argument, the works have to be virtually identical. They have to be so identical as to preclude any reasonable possibility other than copying. And that's just not present here. And, I'll give an example. Garza's a pretty common surname, so that's just not going to be enough. And just last year, I just checked, the court affirmed the dismissal of that case. That case did not, Stallone wins. As you can see here, he's pretty happy. That doesn't pay anything. Now, if you remember, to prove copying, the plaintiff has to show both access and substantial similarity. They have to show both. So I'd like to turn quickly just to the idea of substantial similarity, which itself is a two-part test. There's an extrinsic test, which is a very objective test. And then there's the intrinsic test, which Really, it's basically a jury question. That second intrinsic test, it's you're at the jury, and you basically just ask the jury, say, would a reasonable person looking and comparing the two works believe that they are substantially similar in overall concepts and feel? With respect to movies and television shows in particular, the real question is whether the ordinary reasonable juror would believe that the defendant's work is a dramatization or picturization of the plaintiff's work. If the answer is yes, then the plaintiff's good. But you still have to satisfy that extrinsic test, like I said, which is very objective. And I'm going to focus on that test more because that's where the real fight is in these cases. Access, but also on the substantial similarity part, you really look at this extrinsic test. So it's worth really sort of knowing that a little bit better. So what you do with the extrinsic test is a, like I said, objective test. What you do is you put the plaintiff's work, you put it right next to the defendant's work, you look at them side by side, and you compare the elements listed here, from plot to themes, all the way down to the characters, to the sequence of events. That's what you're looking at. And you have to make a determination whether or not they're substantially similar on those bases. Now, it's become increasingly clear to us, we've seen so many of these cases over the years, that clever litigants, clever plaintiffs can turn just about anything whatsoever into a copyright infringement case, no matter how different the works really are, and which is one of the reasons why you have to be careful of access. That hopefully you're following that, but you got to be really careful in these sorts of cases because anyone can make two works sound similar. And if you don't believe me, I thought we'd give a good example today with a movie, a couple of movies that hopefully all of us have seen, we're familiar with, The Wizard of Oz versus Star Wars. And I thought I'd apply the extrinsic test just if I were such a clever plaintiff and I really wanted someone to pay me. So let's start with the plot. The main characters of each movie are teenagers, Dorothy Gale and Luke Skywalker. So they're teenagers who've grown up on a farm. Each live with their aunt and uncle, and their parents are strangely unaccounted for. After an encounter with a mysterious old stranger, tragedy intervenes, sending the teenager off on an adventure. There's an incident with little people, Munchkins versus Jawas. Both Luke and Dorothy are carried high into the sky where their adventure begins. Each meets helpful companions along the way, including a metal man and a big furry guy. Each has to face an arch-villain, the Wicked Witch of the West, Darth Vader. Each villain lives in a giant fortress, wears a black cape, has a disfigured face, and uses evil, magic evil. That's what they use. In the end, both teenagers triumph over the evil, and each uses unseen supernatural power that they've had with them the whole time. Luke uses the Force, Dorothy uses the power of the magic ruby slippers. The main characters are praised and they line up at the end to receive their due reward. If you look at the characters, besides Dorothy and Luke, you've got the lion and Chewbacca, both big furry guys who roar loudly. And it can't be any coincidence that Dorothy calls the lion a big coward, and in Star Wars, some of you may recall that Han Solo refers to Chewbacca as a big coward as well. That cannot be coincidence. Don't Jawas and Munchkins look and sound an awful lot alike? And finally, when characters are killed, they disappear, leaving only a cloak. Even their weapons are lined up in the same way on the right. This has to be a copy. It has to be. So the Copyright Act, now that I've said that, I can tell you the truth, I don't think these works are similar at all. But the Copyright Act recognizes that people can make anything sound similar. And the courts basically, and the federal courts and federal rules account for this sort of problem in applying the extrinsic test. There's a number of elements before you get to here that have to be filtered out and not even looked at as part of the analysis. Now at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Hajir to talk about these principles, these filtering out principles, and see how that's played out in a number of recent cases.
Good morning. How's everyone doing?
Very good.
So one of the reasons that I love this Star Wars and Wizard of Oz example that Lee talks about is that it really demonstrates how an aggressive plaintiff can take two things that are entirely dissimilar, at least not substantially similar in their protectable elements, and try to demonstrate that there is purportedly copyright infringement happening there. But there has to be a way for attorneys to protect their clients against this type of reason. And fortunately, what copyright law allows is that that extrinsic test that Lee was talking about, in applying that, a court has to filter out, disregard, ignore a number of things akin to what Lee was talking about that an aggressive plaintiff might try to use. What are some examples of that? Well, basic plot ideas for a story. As Lee mentioned, under copyright law, no one can own the idea for a story. Ideas are unprotected. So to use the Star Wars and Wizard of Oz example, for instance, the idea of teenagers having an adventure and facing evil villains would not be protectable. A court would have to disregard that similarity. So whether it's Dorothy versus the Wicked Witch or Luke Skywalker versus Darth Vader, that matchup is not something that a court can consider in an infringement case. Another example is things called scene faire, or scenes which must be done. Scene faire are situations and events that flow naturally from the basic plot premise. They're incidents that are standard to the treatment of any particular topic. So, for instance, in an alien movie, like take E.T., for example, or Mac and Me, or Starman, movies about a friendly alien who happens to land on Earth, they're likely to have a spaceship, a scene where humans are afraid of the alien, you know, the government coming in and trying to capture or destroy the alien, and then the alien finally attempting to return home. Those elements are scene faire, or scenes that are so common to the basic premise of a friendly alien visiting Earth that they're not protectable under copyright law, and a plaintiff cannot rely on those types of elements to argue for infringement. So, for instance, another example, villains very often wear black and are disfigured or otherwise ugly, like Darth Vader or the Wicked Witch, another scene faire example. Another idea of something that has to be filtered out is similarities that exist at such a high level of generality. Those cannot support a copyright infringement claim. And a plaintiff, even if a plaintiff gives a laundry list of a bunch of general similarities, that will not suffice to establish copyright infringement. And that rule solves the problem that we saw in the Wizard of Oz and Star Wars example. Because if you really look at the works in any detail, you see that they really are different. Elements that the defendant created prior to having access to the plaintiff's work also must be filtered out. I don't know if anybody has seen the Reese Witherspoon film Sweet Home Alabama. It's a great example of how this prior access being filtered out analysis works. This case is called Benjamin versus Walt Disney Company. The plaintiff was a producer who sued Walt Disney and alleged that his screenplay called Rescue Me was the basis for the film Sweet Home Alabama. Now, the works did bear some significant similarities, particularly in terms of their storylines. Both were about a woman who reconsiders a marriage proposal after reconnecting with her estranged husband. And in both works, the woman's divorce is not final, and in the end, she chooses the estranged husband over the eligible bachelor fiancé. Now, luckily for Disney in this case, the folks who pitched Sweet Home Alabama, they kept their pitch materials. And in this case, the court found that because the people who pitched Sweet Home Alabama to Disney did not have access to the plaintiff's screenplay when they first pitched the film, their original pitch materials, which consisted of a 17-page treatment, could not have been copied from the plaintiff's work. So again, because the people who pitched it didn't have access to the plaintiff's work at the time of the pitch, then the pitch materials couldn't form the basis of a claim. So the court held that all of those elements that appeared in the pitch materials had to be filtered out and disregarded from that substantial similarity analysis because they were pre-access materials. And then once all of those pre-access materials were filtered out, there wasn't really anything left to compare with the plaintiff's screenplay. So the court found that the two works were not substantially similar and granted summary judgment to Disney, dismissing the plaintiff's case. So a clear lesson to be learned, a practical lesson from this case, is that it is very important to hold on to pitch materials, because those can be evidence that can be crucial to show pre-access creation. Well, now that we've discussed what might be protectable and what isn't, let's take a look at a couple of specific case examples where courts actually applied the substantial similarity analysis. We're going to take a look at a couple of games in the video game context. Up to this point, we've been talking a lot about written works and films, but it's important to remember that regardless of the nature of the work, whether it's a film, television show, or book, copyright analysis is the same. So this first case that we'll talk about is called Wild versus NBC Universal. In this case, Jazan Wild, the author of a graphic novel called The Carnival of Souls, sued NBC and alleged that NBC's TV series, Heroes, infringed his copyright in his novel. So NBC brought a motion to dismiss, and the court looked at the two works, Carnival of Souls and Heroes, to see if they were substantially similar in their protectable elements. To support his claim, in this complaint, this plaintiff did some creative stuff. He juxtaposed a number of screenshots from his from the TV show Heroes with individual frames from his graphic novel Carnival of Souls. And based on those side-by-side snapshots, Wild argued that the works were visually similar. So for example, here's what Wild showed. Here we see a comparison of A House of Mirrors. Wild showed on the left an image of a character approaching a house of mirrors. The House of Mirrors is predominantly red with some blue and gold coloring. Now on the right, you see a screenshot from Heroes where the viewer appears to be approaching a House of Mirror with similar colors. In his complaint, Wild also showed an entrance scene. On the left, from his work, a young boy approaching the entrance to a carnival or carnival attraction. The sign, if you can't read it, says Freak Show. In the upper left corner of the frame, you see a Ferris wheel. On the right, from Heroes, you see what seems to be, again, an entrance of a carnival. There's a ticket booth in the lower right-hand corner, a sign for a rollerball near the center, and a Ferris wheel in the upper left portion of the shot. Again, the plaintiff trying to demonstrate visual similarities. And another example, a carnival barker. On the left, you see a point-of-view shot of a carnival barker taking money or otherwise interacting with a person from a first-person viewpoint. And on the right, you see a shot of someone facing what looks to be a carnival attendant. On the left, someone in the lower left-hand corner of the shot looking some distance forward at an approximately 45-degree angle, and there's a shadowy, somewhat obstructed figure in their line of sight. On the right side, you see something pretty similar visually in those respects. Another example about House of Mirrors. On the left, you see someone actually inside a House of Mirrors with surrounded by reflections, and you see something similar on the right. And also in these two, you see that the person who's in the House of Mirrors doesn't quite seem to match up with the reflection in the mirrors. And then finally, a powerful force inside the House of Mirrors is depicted in both the shot on the left from Wild's work and on the right in NBC Universal's screenshot from Heroes. So, pop quiz. What do you think the court decided when faced with these visual similarities? Any guesses on whether this amounted legally to substantial similarities? Whoever guessed the answer to be no wins. The case was dismissed. The court decided that these juxtaposed images are simply unprotectable stock scenes or scène-à-faire, scenes that naturally flow from the basic premise. Both of the works were about carnivals. What we've seen here is the presence of generic carnival elements in both of them. A carnival entrance, carnival barker or attendant, a house of mirrors, working the way that a house of mirrors typically works. Things that are very similar and common to any particular carnival scene. And once the court disregarded those general similarities, It determined that anything that was left between the two actual works were random similarities scattered through the works that were not sufficient to support a claim of substantial similarity. So in the end, Love lost this case, and NBC got reimbursed for its troubles to the tune of $113,000 in change when the court awarded NBC its attorney's fees and costs for successfully defending the claim. And just a footnote to that, although Wilde appealed, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who reviewed the case, affirmed that judgment. Next, we'll talk about another case. This one in the realm of video games. Actually, the last one was not about video games, obviously, television production. But this is the one that demonstrates that the same analysis applies in the realm of video games. This case is called Bassoon Duff versus Sony Computer Entertainment. It's a strange case from 2010 involving the PlayStation game God of War. The plaintiff in this case, Jonathan Bassoon Duff, filed a suit and alleged that Sony and the designer of the game God of War infringed his copyrights to one or more of the following works. Jonathan Bassoon Duff, I'll call him Duff for short, had two treatments. Theseus, a screenplay treatment, and The Adventures of Owen, and also had two screenplays titled Olympiad Version A and Olympiad. And each of the plaintiff's works told a similar story. After Sparta attacks Athens, the gods gather to complain about all the war that was going on in Greece. Zeus had this idea to order a truce and order people to participate in an Olympiad. But Ares, Apollo, and Hermes object. Ultimately, the gods agree that Zeus will choose a mortal whose quest will be to convince Athens and Sparta to declare a truce. Ultimately, and another spoiler alert, the mortal does succeed. A truce is declared, and the Olympic Games are held in Sparta. But then, Sparta secretly attacks Athens while the games are going on. And ultimately, a mass of people rise up and liberate Athens, and peace and democracy reign over Greece. God of War, the allegedly infringing game, features the warrior Kratos, who fights human and mythical foes and ultimately replaces Ares as the God of War. From his throne, he oversees various modern wars, including World War II and the Vietnam War, and it later turns out that Kratos is actually the son of Zeus and a mortal Spartan woman. Conducting the substantial similarity analysis to the plot of these two works, the court unsurprisingly determined that although there were some plot similarities, those similarities were so general and common to stories involving questing heroes as to be unprotectable. It's really more of a heroic cycle straight out of Joseph Campbell. And as the court noted, popular culture iterations of classic Greek mythology like Wonder Woman, as well as ancient stories such as Hesiod's Theogony, these all contain plot lines involving various combinations of war and rivalries among the Greek gods. So, unable to establish substantial similarities in plot, the plaintiff tried to pluck out pieces of dialogue from the God of War video game that he claimed were pulled essentially verbatim from his own works. So, for example, in his works, Zeus says to Athena and Ares, "Stop it right now, the two of you. There has been more than enough argument between mortals and among us gods." In God of War, Zeus says, "Enough, both of you. Your childish quibbles are your own, but I do not want this war encroaching on the steps of Mount Olympus." And so the court, maybe getting a little frustrated with the plaintiff at this point, concluded, quote, "While the first sentences of these statements are somewhat similar, the language is ordinary, cliched, and likely has been spoken by every mother of multiple children. The second sentences are not substantially similar. The first speaks to the unfortunate prevalence of contentious natures among both mortals and gods. The latter speaks to the potential spread of a particular war against Athens." End quote. Now I read you this excerpt from the court's opinion there because it demonstrates how extremely granular the level of detail gets that the courts get into when they're conducting the substantial similarity analysis. It's actually one of the reasons why we enjoy practicing copyright law, is it allows you to get into these very creative and detail-oriented analysis. So in urging the court to find similarities in the characters, because he fails on plot and dialogue, the plaintiff pointed to characters such as Ares, Zeus, and Athena. Of course, these are mostly unprotectable elements from the public domain, as the court noted, and so they again have to be filtered out of the analysis. The plaintiff also focused on purported similarities between the protagonist in his work and Kratos in God of War, but this didn't work either. His protagonist is a sheepherder, generally nonviolent and kind. He's plagued by self-doubt caused by his parents' ridicule of him when he was young. God of War, on the other hand, features Kratos, who is bald, muscular, and covered in red tattoos and pale ashes. He has large blades chained to his forearms. This is no shepherd. In the court's estimation, rather, he is disturbingly prone to violence and does not hesitate to kill. So in short, the protagonists are strikingly different. Ultimately, the court concluded that there was no way any juror could find substantial similarity, and as such, there could be no copyright infringement claim. Now, you might wonder why access wasn't more of an issue here, given that none of us have heard of the plaintiff's works. He actually did have an access theory. He claimed that he distributed his work to various agents around town, including the huge agencies ICM and CAA, and both of those agencies had direct connections to Sony, which published God of War. But the court didn't even have to get to the access issue in this case, since it found that there was no substantial similarity in protectable elements. So as a PS to this case, before you feel too bad for this lawyer, before you feel too bad for the plaintiff, in spite of his loss, he bounced back. In fact, he is now himself a lawyer with a family practice in Sacramento. There's one other thing I wanted to mention to you is a recent trend that we've been seeing a lot lately in copyright law, which involves the preliminary draft of screenplays of a defendant's motion picture or television series. We're noticing that plaintiffs have been trying to introduce the defendant's preliminary script, not the final version, into the substantial similarity analysis. So what we're seeing over and over again is that the plaintiff makes a list of points that are similar between his or her work and various versions of the defendant's work. Similarities from the defendant's movie, for example, and then also from various drafts of the screenplay for that movie. So the plaintiff may pick out a similarity from the early screenplay, another similarity from a different draft of the screenplay, and then compare it to his or her own work. And there's a well-established rule that such a practice is not allowed in copyright cases. The rule is that only the final version of the defendant's work, as it is presented to the public, so in other words, a finished movie, should be considered in determining substantial similarity between the defendant and the plaintiff's work. And courts thus routinely reject plaintiff's request to consider earlier drafts, including in conducting a substantial similarity analysis. And one rationale for this, that if you think about it, makes sense, is that in a creative process, a defendant may purposefully make changes to a plaintiff's work in order to create a new work. And if the end result, after all of those changes in the evolution of the work, is that the final product is not substantially similar to the plaintiff's work, then there is no infringement. But plaintiffs have been trying to get around this rule recently. And so they're trying to attempt to plead a separate and distinct infringement claim based upon each unpublished draft of a work. So they say the draft itself is an infringing work in addition to the infringing movie being a separate infringement work. So instead of one copyright claim in a case, you see multiple copyright claims. And so one federal court has rejected this theory. In Flaherty versus Filarty, a case involving the Steve Martin Queen Latifah movie Bringing Down the House, a district court specifically tackled the plaintiff's attempt to get around that rule. And they found that the Bringing Down the House, the finished version of the movie, was not substantially similar to the plaintiff's work, and then said with respect to the interim draft, the drafts prepared in the interim were not infringing final work, and thus they were not actionable under the Copyright Act. So in other words, because the final work was not an infringing work, the preliminary draft of something that was not ultimately not infringing could not be actionable under the Copyright Act. So this is an emerging question, and we expect to see more litigation and case law surrounding this issue. So based on this potential problem, it might seem like a good idea for defendants not to keep their preliminary drafts. Well, if you're worried about a copyright claim against a preliminary draft, why wouldn't you want to destroy or get rid of those preliminary drafts? But something else to consider. There's still a good reason to keep your preliminary drafts because you can use them to show independent creation. You can show that the preliminary draft demonstrates that you created that work completely independent of whatever the plaintiff's work was. And as we discussed earlier, elements that were created prior to access should be filtered out of the substantial similarity comparison. I want to leave you with one final thought before I turn it over to Dave, and that people forget that under the Copyright Act, it is perfectly legal, perfectly okay, for an author to be directly inspired by a prior work. In fact, in order to promote the progress of arts and sciences, the Copyright Act is actually designed to encourage the free use of ideas and allow people to build freely upon those ideas. We're supposed to inspire each other. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Dave to talk about state law idea theft claims. As you'll see that although we are supposed to inspire each other, that inspiration is not always free of charge.
Good morning, everybody. My name is David Fink. I'm going to be shifting gears a little bit, and I'm going to talk about a cousin or sister claim to copyright infringement claims that we see in the entertainment business, and those are called idea submission claims. In the entertainment industry, sometimes copyright claims are accompanied by idea submission claims under state law. And the laws vary from state to state in the United States, but California was really the front runner in this area, and as a result of that, California kind of sets the tone for the rest of the United States. In the copyright context, it's the expression of the idea that qualifies for copyright protection, not the idea itself. And ideas for films and television series usually aren't regarded as property. Our concept of property implies ownership and possession to the exclusion of others. And it's been said in this famous case, which I'm going to discuss in just a minute, from 1956, the case that started it all, Desney versus Wilder, that ideas are free as the air. But we know better. Few things come for free and without a price, and in the entertainment business, it's common practice to conceive and sell ideas. So these ideas can be protected under a variety of different theories that arise under state law. And I've listed here just a few of them, and I'll run through them, but I'm going to focus on one today because we have such limited time. But we can have an express contract, a written contract, where the parties make an agreement to pay for the idea, an implied contract, which we're going to talk about at some length today, breach of confidence, in which somebody makes an agreement to keep the secret, the idea a secret, fraud, which we covered earlier, trade secret, unjust enrichment, and pretty much anything else that a creative plaintiff can think of. But while these ideas can be subject to numerous claims, the most frequently litigated claim is based on breach of implied contract. That's what we call the Desney claim. And this claim traces back to the 1950s, in this case, Desney versus Wilder, in which the California Supreme Court confirmed that ideas can be the subject of contracts. And the court remarked that even though an idea is not properly subject to exclusive ownership, It's the disclosure of the idea that can be of substantial benefit to the person that's receiving the idea. So Desney has some interesting facts. Desney involved a plaintiff, a man named Victor Desney, and he submitted an idea for a motion picture about the real-life tragedy of a man named Floyd Collins, who died of starvation after being trapped in a cave for about 14 days. Desney pitched this idea to Billy Wilder's secretary. At the time, Billy Wilder, like a lot of other movie writers and producers, was working at Paramount Pictures on the lot. And after a couple of calls with the secretary and attempts to sell this script, a contract was formed which ended up binding both Billy Wilder and Paramount to a contract. And Desney claimed that a film that was subsequently made by Paramount and Wilder was a copy of this, and therefore they were in breach of their contract to pay for his idea. On appeal, the California Supreme Court considered the circumstances under which these ideas could be the subject of a contract, and the court paved the way for idea salesmen around the country to litigate their claims under contract law when the circumstances of the submission gave rise to a contractual relationship. Earlier, we showed that scene from Sunset Boulevard showing Joe Gillis' failed pitch of an idea. Ironically, the Desney case arose from a Billy Wilder film, one of his best, Ace in the Hole, starring Kirk Douglas. Ace in the Hole was the story of a struggling journalist who tried to re-energize his own career by exploiting the tragedy of a character named Leo Mnosa, who was also a man trapped in a cave. The story is kind of a scathing critique, really, of the press in America and the sensationalism that sometimes occurs in news reporting. Ironically, when the film was released in 1951, it wasn't very much of a success in the box office, and it didn't make very much money, even though it got an Oscar nomination for Best Story. On its re-release, the critics liked it a lot better in 2007 after they realized just how good it was. But let's take a look at some of the key elements of a Desney claim. They're pretty obvious. First, the plaintiff has to have prepared an idea, and then he has to disclose the idea under circumstances where it's clear that it's for sale. The defendant has to be listening to the idea and accept the idea knowing that there are conditions to listening to it, and that the conditions are that it will be paid for. And then the defendant has to use the idea without paying for it, and the idea has to be worth something. It has to have some value. So really the fundamental premise of the Desney claim, or the implied contract claim, is that there's a contractual relationship created by the circumstances that give rise for an obligation to pay the plaintiff if the idea that's disclosed is used. But the Desney court cautioned long ago that hopes and dreams of being paid are not enough. The idea man who blurts his idea without having first made his bargain is no one to blame but himself if he doesn't get paid. And the court went on to explain that just because an idea is conveyed and the person conveying it has an expectation or hope that the idea will provide some compensation doesn't mean that you have a claim. The person receiving it has to receive the idea under circumstances which also convey that he's agreeing to pay for it if he uses it. California courts of appeal and courts in other states have adopted this rule and have reaffirmed it time and time again since 1956. And while idea submission claims, they're a different animal from copyright claims, and they arise out of contract formation rather than some code which was created to protect the rights, the courts look to the same basic defenses and notions to determine whether an idea was actually used. So we talked about these elements, but the defenses really become the same. Lack of access, lack of substantial similarity, and then, of course, even if those things exist and there's an inference of use, an independent creation by the creator of the allegedly infringing or offending work, in other words, if the idea was created separately by those people, that's always a defense. So you can always create your own idea, even if it turns out to be identical to somebody else's. Just to get an idea of what the differences of these things are, there was a case that was which I'm going to talk briefly about, called Binet versus Warner Brothers. And in that case, the court had to sort out the differences between these defenses, especially the substantial similarity defense, because that case contained both a copyright claim and an idea submission claim, and they really were pretty similar. In both works, the protagonist was an embittered American war veteran who traveled to Japan, where he met the emperor, trained with the Imperial Army in modern warfare, fought against samurai, and in the end was spiritually restored. Both of them were set in the same time period, the Satsuma Rebellion of 1877. And both works relied heavily on historical figure Saiko Takamori. And both works had the same title. But ultimately what the court did was it divided them, and it took out all those unprotectable elements that Hajir was just talking about, and found out that there wasn't enough substantial similarity to make a copyright claim, but decided that the case could live on as an idea submission case. Ironically, it went to a jury trial, and after 7 days of proceedings, a jury unanimously ultimately concluded that the plaintiff had never established access, and so the claim was dismissed anyway. So even if the plaintiff establishes an inference of use through access and substantial similarity, as I said, that can be rebutted by independent creation. And we were just talking about that, and as courts have noted all the way since the 20s, there's nothing that prohibits anybody from creating their own work if they independently arrive even at the same exact combination of words or notes. So since that time, lots of cases have come down that have showed that independent creation can be a viable way of defeating the claim, even if there's access and even if there is substantial similarity. And there have been many of them that have come down in recent times. And I don't have time to talk about them all, but I am going to talk in particular about one, the Spinner versus American Broadcasting Company case, which I litigated, and so did Hajir, for many, many years on behalf of ABC. But before I do, here's a quick list of things that make for a good independent creation defense, because we're going to take note of them in just a minute. The more documents and notes and evidence you have of the creative process, the more hard evidence, obviously, the better off you are in your independent creation defense, because each piece of that evidence demonstrates the path that the creator took to arrive at the conclusion of his own creative process, or hers. So notes are really important to save, and drafts of scripts and screenplays, works that author collects that inspire him, prior works created by the author that show his own creative arc, real-life events that play upon, that bear upon history and show where the idea came from, and, of course, third-party eyewitness accounts of the creative process can also be important as well. Now we're going to take a look at the Spinner case itself, which was kind of an interesting case. A lot of you might be too young, or I'm not sure whether you had Saturday morning cartoons in the 1970s in India, but here in America, Saturday mornings were a time when network television devoted much of its airtime to children's programming, and in particular, animated shows. And the kings of that genre were two brothers named Sid and Marty Croft, who came up with a bunch of television programs pursuant to an overall deal that they had with ABC, most of which were kind of psychedelic in nature and were really sort of had double meaning and were sort of intended to appeal or be inspired by the drug culture of the 1960s, but were intended to be weird and wacky and funny for children to watch, and they ended up on television. Shows like H&R Puffin Stuff, Sigmund and the Sea Monster, and most importantly for our purposes, a television program called Land of the Lost. And indeed, it was Land of the Lost indirectly that gave rise to this lawsuit. See, Sid and Marty Croft, they didn't want to just be children's programming gurus. They wanted to get into primetime programming on ABC. So they contacted this guy. This is Anthony Spinner, also known as Tony. Tony Spinner was a television writer from the 1950s and 60s and 70s that created a number of popular television shows, or wrote episodes, at least, of them, including shows like Man from U.N.C.L.E., Beretta, and even some episodes of The Love Boat. And Spinner was hired by Sid and Marty Croft to make a program or a script for a feature movie to be on ABC that was based on Land of the Lost. The story was that there were some Olympic athletes that were traveling back from the Olympics on an airplane that crashed in the Himalaya Mountains. And while they were seeking shelter, they went through a portal in the side of the mountain and ended up in a tropical prehistoric world where they were beset by dinosaurs and primitive cave people. In 1976, Mr. Spinner entered into a written contract with ABC and Sid and Marty Croft for his writing services, where they agreed to pay him $30,000, which was top dollar, quite a lot of money in the late 70s, to write the script. And the contract had a lot of the typical provisions in it, including some guild provisions, which ultimately meant that if ABC didn't use the script, that the rights would revert back to Tony Spinner and he would have the right to sell it to somebody else. So what happened to the lost script exactly? This was a long time ago. So in 1977, he submitted the script to ABC, and ABC put the script in development. But it wasn't meant to be. It was too expensive, and there were all kinds of problems with it, and they never really liked it very much. Frankly, I didn't really think it was very good. I had to read it about 100 times. And the decades passed, and the script went away, and all the people that worked there disappeared. The two executives that worked there were gone 2 years later. And Spinner worked on some other projects, but every once in a while, he just couldn't resist trying to resubmit the same script. So every once in a while, he would dust it off and change the name and find some new executives at ABC and send it in again. One time, he made it into an outer space movie, and he changed the characters around to make space travel, but he just kept resubmitting it, and each time he resubmitted it, the executive in charge would pass on the script and say no and send it back and say that they didn't like it. And he did that again as most recently in 1991 and 1994. Now, 30 years after this script was originally written, there were these other guys named J.J. Abrams, who you may know from the show Alias and the Star Trek movies, a writer named Jeffrey Lieber, who was also very well known, and the man who later became J.J. Abrams' sidekick in Hollywood, Damon Lindelof. They also were completely aware of Tony Spinner's script when they were hired to write the television show, which ultimately became Lost on ABC, which premiered in the United States in 2004 during the fall television season. and was a huge success and was on for 6 seasons and many, many episodes. So in August of 2005, Spinner came out of retirement, filed a Desney claim, breach of contract claim, against ABC. And we filed a summary judgment motion, and we used the same traditional defenses that were being talked about with respect to copyright. We said that there wasn't any access, because even though it was clear that ABC paid for and received the script, nobody that was around in 1977 was around anymore in 2003 to even know that ABC had the script, if ABC had the script. And ultimately, when ABC searched all of its records, it couldn't find the script. We moved based on the lack of substantial similarity, which we thought would be the reason why it would be dismissed, because the two works were in front of the court, and they could look at the two works and realize they really weren't that similar. And then, of course, as a throwaway almost, because there were so many facts involved, we put in our independent creation defense on summary judgment, thinking that we might as well give it a shot. And what we didn't know was that the substantial similarity would be the one area where the court wasn't interested in looking because of the strength of the other two defenses. So first, the court found that there was no access, and it relied on a principle of copyright law called the bare corporate receipt doctrine. And essentially what that is it's a recognition under the copyright law, and now because of this case, under state law claims, that companies can be very large, like ABC, for example, having thousands of employees and multiple offices in many locations. And so just because you give something to somebody at the company doesn't mean that the entire company has the work. And so it's now been established for a pretty long time that the people who actually are producing the show or the movie or the work that's the target of the lawsuit have to be proven to have actual access or at least a reasonable possibility of access. It's not enough just to send it to the company. And when we talk about the time being a factor here, just to give you some context, the three fellows who actually ended up writing Lost, the series, Jeffrey Lieber, J.J. Abrams, and Damon Lindelof, all of them were under 11 years old when Tony Spinner wrote the original script that he submitted. They were just children playing on a schoolyard someplace. And that was a very persuasive argument. It really was a long, long time. The court also dismissed the case based on independent creation. And what's noteworthy about this is that in this particular case, the script had been submitted years before the independent creation actually occurred. And usually when you have an independent creation defense, you have something that we like to call prior art. And one of the ways you prove it's independent, or one of the easiest ways at least, is to prove that the creation of the allegedly offending work happened before the plaintiff created his own work, or at least before he shared it with anybody. But in this case, the work was 30 years old, and it was pretty clear that at least at one point ABC had a copy of this script in its possession. So it was really an interesting result to be able to prove independent creation at this later time. But we did it because we had such amazing documentary evidence. This fellow here on the left is a guy named Lloyd Braun. And he came up with this idea for Lost while he was sitting on a beach in Hawaii. And he got this idea of crossing the television show Survivor with the motion picture Castaway. And that's how he came up, supposedly, with this idea for Lost. But that in and of itself wasn't so remarkable. But what was remarkable is that a month or two later, he was sitting at an ABC corporate retreat at Disneyland in some office. And he was under tremendous pressure to come up with ideas, as were all the other executives. And the company had hired a certified court reporter to transcribe all of the things that were said in the meeting so that no one would forget any of the ideas. So we actually had a certified transcript of Lloyd Braun pitching this idea to a room full of executives in 2013, and we knew exactly what he said and what idea he pitched, word for word, which was really quite a lucky thing. And then we also had the writers. The writers kept tons of notes. They made numerous drafts. And the three of them, Lieber, Lindelof, and Abrams, all got into a dispute at the Writers Guild over writing credits, and all of these materials had been submitted and collected in one place, drawers full of it, at the Writers Guild. And so we literally had, as the Court of Appeal called it, boatloads of evidence of this independent creation. And in fact, there was just so much evidence that this program was independently recreated, regardless of the access, that the court just refused to believe Spinner's story and just said, you know what, enough is enough. This is really clear, positive evidence, and there's no reasonable way to contradict it. And so new law was made in the state arena, both on the issue of the bare corporate receipt doctrine being applied to a California contract claim for the first time, and with this independent creation defense being asserted after the time that the original script was submitted. So it was a good case, and it advanced the ball a bit. Now what we're going to do is just talk a little bit, very, very briefly. Yeah, I'm just going to just take another 2 minutes to talk to you about some cautionary things. If you find yourself in a situation in your own work, receiving ideas from other people. So here are just a couple of little tips. First of all, it's a good idea not to take unsolicited materials from people that you don't know. So reject unsolicited materials. They can buy you nothing but headaches, and they're almost never very good. Most people who are really good get agents and get people to that you will know to bring them to you, so it's a bad idea. If you're concerned about people submitting them through websites or email depositories, come up with a form of a rejection email that says that you're destroying the script, you're not reading it, you're returning it. We've seen recently a rash of people who get listserv email addresses of like all of the executives of some company and then send the same copy. They carpet bomb the whole company, send thousands of copies. And the way we deal with that is we just remove them from a server and send one email back that says, we don't accept unsolicited scripts. We really don't want you to send our executives any emails. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. You can also, if you're going to have a submission from somebody, you can draft releases, and there are forms for this, which we can provide to help you memorialize what the terms are of receiving that. And then a couple of final thoughts. Always best if you're going to have people that read scripts, like that woman in the Sunset Boulevard who was from the reader pool who did a coverage. I have a single reader pool of people, so there aren't people reading scripts all over the company. Have some protocols for your meetings and hopefully have a third person there to take notes and memorialize what was said. And another important one is, if for any reason you're listening to a pitch from somebody, you already know that your studio or your company has an idea that's similar, stop the person from talking, say you're sorry, but you already have an idea like that in the works, and you really don't see any point in, you know, thank you for coming, but it's probably time to end the pitch. And above all, save all your records of all the meetings and all your drafts of the works that you create. So with that, I will thank you on behalf of all of us.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming, and we hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I mean, feel free to ask now, or I think you have our bios maybe there, and we can be reached with questions now or later. So, thank you.
Hi, so before we actually open for questions, I mean, we were just so eager and excited to hear our friends from Kelly Dry that We actually missed in introducing our speakers today. So I'm just going to give a very quick introduction for each one of them, given that we do have a number of our friends even joining us on the dial-in today. So David Fink, of course, who spoke on the idea of submission law, he's the managing partner of the firm at the LA office and the former chair of the media entertainment practice group there. And his practice primarily includes business employment and entertainment matters, and he has an emphasis on the First Amendment, entertainment, and IP litigation. His creative strategies and litigation style have obviously enabled him to achieve highly favorable results in a wide variety of complex disputes in trial and appellate courts throughout the U.S. In addition, he's been representing major news, media, television, and entertainment clients. We also have Lee Brenner, who took the first half of the session. He is a partner at the LA office and the chair of the M&E practice group there. And he serves as a counsel for individuals, television networks, production companies, corporations, and partnerships in business, media, entertainment, employment, and commercial lawsuits. And my apologies, but I think I didn't really catch the name of your third colleague, but I think it's Hajir, right?
It's Hajir Ardabili.
Well, thank you. Thank you. My apologies for the pronunciation if that went wrong. But Hajir is a special counsel with the LA office, and his practice includes complex business cases, entertainment litigation, IP matters, real estate, and First Amendment litigation. Thank you, three of you, for sharing your knowledge and your experience with us today. If I may request our colleague at the course call to open questions.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one at this time.
And again, if you have any questions that come up later, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We could talk about this stuff all day. You're probably going to think that we love talking about these issues, so feel free.
I think one thing we had discussed, Lee and David, was, you know, the experts that you mentioned who are the, basically are just so avid readers that they, you know, basically can trace the origin of, you know, the ideas in different, sort of sources. You could just probably spend a minute or so, you know, explaining how it works and how you, you know, have these witnesses available.
Could you ask how to trace the sources back of how the idea came to
play? Yeah, you know, when we met with you in your offices in LA, you had told us about how you have some experts who are able to quickly identify the sources.
Yes. Basically, you know, it is one of the things that you want to show in copyright claims and certain other claims is that certain ideas are really prevalent. So as Hajir talked about, there's something called senefair, for example, which are, as Hajir mentioned, are themes that must be done, that are common themes. And so a lot of times in these cases, what we'll do when someone will say, look, these two works look exactly alike, we'll say, well, look, there's another 30 that have the exact same element. So there are experts out there. They're really called prior art experts. And what we do is we will, although we've actually become those experts over the years, but we will actually go out and find some other experts too who basically they just know so many things. Like they'll, you know, I had a case about where a common theme of a mother-in-law who was very unlikable. And so I hired an expert, and he was able to go find things all the way back to, I don't know, all the way through back to the beginning of history of people not liking their mother-in-law. And so I was able to show basically that said, okay, yeah, we have the similarity, but so do all these other works from the beginning of time. It's fun working with those experts. They're a bit like investigators who can just find the same elements, the same sort of features from various works over and over and over again. And it gives us a leg up to say, look, this wasn't copied. This is just a really common element.
Right.
But actually, the concept of senefair is something which is also developed in the Indian context of late. A couple of the principles actually that you spoke about, right, about access of the script, center fair test, all of these things are now slowly, we do see that they're finding place in Indian case laws as well. And very recently, we actually dealt with the case where we were trying to do something extremely similar. Actually, we were faced with something similar. We were on the plaintiff's side where we were dealing with a script which was basically based on our client's book on human trafficking. And, you know, the opposite side was looking at a similar kind of strategy where they were trying to show that there is a lot of material out there on human trafficking. And essentially, what we were claiming as infringement was really center fair. And there's a lot of material which was a similar line which is already existing. So they used a very similar strategy. But what's really happened in the Indian context is a lot of these places have not really gone the full trial. They've really stopped at the preliminary stage of an interim injunction. So, you know, we don't really have a lot of jurisprudence to really go down to see whether these cases would muster the tests that have developed problems in the U.S. context. But yet we have seen similar kind of things happening even in the Indian context. You did give an example of ET. We, in fact, have a case in India where center fair was used in the context of ET. So we have seen these things, Sid, and the Marty case is another case which has been referred to in the Indian case laws as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of similarity that we do see.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, anytime you're talking about center fair, it's really helpful to have, you know, an expert. It is. It's really good to have. And on either side, even on the plaintiff side, you know, what I would do on the plaintiff side is say, yeah, it's common, but look, ours is different. Ours is expressed differently and a lot like the defendant's work. So, yeah, you can have the same common, you know, idea, but on the plaintiff side, I'll say, yeah, but it's still close to ours. You know, it just, I would try to use it as more evidence of that it was copied on the plaintiff side. But you can have an expert on both sides. It can be very helpful.
Thanks.
And every element that you have that's really unique, it helps you chip away a little bit as a center fair defense, as a plaintiff.
Right.
So you can try to argue around the commonality of the work by trying to introduce the things that are similar, that are really truly unique.
Understood. Anybody any questions?
Yes, we just did.
I have a
question.
Sure.
Hi, this is Anand. I don't know if I'm there on the video. But I had a couple of questions. One is, how do you deal with, say, parody adaptation? Now, certain images, visuals, dialogues are often repeated. So you take Darth Vader. So you have the Darth Vader march, which was used in the Volkswagen advertisement. Then you have the dialogue from the Terminator, the Godfather, where they use not just the dialogue but also the voice in which, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger said it or Marlon Brando spoke as the Godfather. So what are the laws relating to copyright with respect to these kind of adaptations? That's one. And a second question is, what do you do in cases where, what do you do with respect to the issue of jurisdiction? So let's say that someone wants to, you know, there is something which is really popular like Harry Potter, and someone from a place like Tennessee or something, you know, says that I want to bring a suit for injunction against J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. Where would this person go and find the suit?
Why do you do the right for most of them?
What?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you, on the first, I can talk a little bit, and I'll ask Dave to jump in. On the first question, which was, how are they using the voice and, you know, some of the verbiage, you know, the first thing when you talk about the voice, the first thing that jumps to mind for me is right of publicity, meaning someone had to get James Earl Jones's permission probably to use the voice, probably. In addition to that, I suspect they had the right. I mean, I don't think that these guys went out and took now Disney's rights and used it in a car commercial without getting a license from Disney. I would be, having worked for Disney, I would be shocked and blown away if there wasn't a deal there. I can't imagine that they just used it willy-nilly.
But there's a concept in the trademark law that says, that carries over a little bit into right of publicity sometimes, that the owner of the trademark is burdened with the job of policing his mark. And the right of publicity kind of goes the same way, but the thing about the right of publicity in the United States is it's not codified in any kind of federal law. So the rights vary that each person has from state to state here, and it can be very complicated to try to sort out what you can do and what you can't do with respect to the right to use somebody's voice or likeness or their photograph or anything like that. And so the common safe practice is to find out who the rights holder is. For example, I represent the estate of Elizabeth Taylor, and people are constantly approaching the estate to get licenses to use Elizabeth Taylor's image. And so the safe thing to do is to just pay for a license and get approval, and that way you don't have to worry about it.
Right. And then if you want to learn more about right of publicity, we actually have a blog where we actually did a multi-part series on these right of publicity issues, when you can use someone's name, voice, or likeness in connection with advertising. We did a multiple-part series on it. It's actually a pretty interesting question, and it's fun stuff, and it's really interesting stuff. On the jurisdiction question, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. Jurisdiction question. I'm sorry about that.
Let me just repeat it. So let's say there's someone in rural America who wants to bring a suit against J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers, right? And this person says, the plaintiff says that the whole Harry Potter series is a copy of some written work that this plaintiff came up with in sitting in rural America. Now, where would this person, and Harry Potter is about to release now in, that's going to be a worldwide release or whatever else. So where would this plaintiff go to file a suit restraining Warner Brothers or Visual Studio Theaters from releasing the movie? So there are two parts. Practically, how we see it is, one, let's say that even if you did file the suit in a court of convenient jurisdiction, for you to enforce that order, you're going to have to ultimately go to a place where the defendants are residing. So how do you balance the issue of what is convenient for the plaintiff and what is practical to enforce?
So if I'm understanding your question correctly, and I may not be because of the video feed, it's a little bit echoey here. So I think what you're asking is, if you have a claim, let's say, against a big company and something's going to be released in multiple jurisdictions, where do you go to file the lawsuit if you want to file a lawsuit?
Yeah,
that's the question?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
that's the question.
So in America, the rule is that you can file a lawsuit any place where the company that you're suing or the defendant has personal contact or is doing business. So in the case of like a movie where Warner Brothers or somebody is releasing a movie, if it's a nationwide release, then you can sue them anywhere in America. And if it's an international release, then it depends upon the various treaties and relationships between the countries. But you can usually sue them. Sometimes you can sue them in America and enforce in another country, depending on what the circumstances are, but sometimes you've got to try to go after them in the other country. For example, I know that there's a great deal of difficulty in bringing copyright claims in China for American plaintiffs.
Thank you.
Right.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We know that it's getting very late for you, and we really appreciate this. And we, your permission, we may also make it available on our website, this entire recording for, anybody would have access later as well. Thanks a lot for all your help. Thank you. And I have a good
time. Thank you very much.
Time.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Have a nice day.
Bye.
Thank you all participants on the audio bridge. With this, we conclude today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.